Round of applause.
I'm glad to see that the hardcore is here this afternoon. My name is Charlie Parmley, and I am a very grateful recovering alcoholic. And because I'm a member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and by the grace of the power that I found in the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found necessary to take a drink for 6,002 days today, one day at a time, and for this I'm very grateful. And again, it's great to be here and have the opportunity to talk a little bit about one of the subjects that's near and dear to my heart. We're going to talk about sex this afternoon. But at my age, you can't go into it too fast, so we're going to gradually work up to it. But before I do that, I want to tell a joke. Like I said yesterday, I always love to tell one story to kind of get me settled down, get the butterflies settled down, and my stories usually are about a drunk of some kind or other. And this particular one that I heard not too long ago was about a drunken burglar, and he had broken into a home one night, and there was no lights on in the home. The only light that he had was a little pencil flashlight, and he looked around, and he finally found the wall safe, and he was working on the wall safe trying to get it open, and a little voice said, Jesus sees you. And he jumped and he jerked and he flashed that light around and he didn't see anything at all. And he went back to working on the safe again. And after a while, the voice said, Jesus is watching you. And he jumped and again he flashed the light around and he didn't see anything at all. And he starts working back on the safe again. And a little while, the little voice said, Jesus is going to get you. And he jumped and he flashed that light around again, and this time he flashed it in a corner where it hadn't been before, and there was a bird cage there and a parrot in the bird cage. And he said, oh, you damn crazy bird, you don't know what you're talking about. And he turned to go back to the wall safe. As he did, his light went across the doorway, and there stood a great big German shepherd dog with his lips snarled back and his fangs showing, and the little voice said, sick him, Jesus. This subject that we're going to discuss this afternoon, I don't know of anything that we talk about more and probably know less about than what we're going to try to talk about this afternoon. But before we actually start talking about sex itself, I think we need to start looking a little bit about this thing that makes we human beings tick, a little bit about what causes self and self-will, and a little bit about the things that control the way we think, which in turn controls the decisions we make, which in turn controls the way that we act. You know, prior to coming to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought I was a reasonably intelligent human being. But I find after I came to AA and began to read and study the big book and look at some other information that AA had, that I knew very, very little about how to live. The only thing I knew that most of my life I had been driven by such things as wanting power, such things as wanting prestige, such things as wanting money, such things as wanting recognition, such things as sex, and so on and so forth. And I knew that those drives within me were very, very strong. And I knew that they were so strong that they, in turn, caused me to have a lot of anger when people would interfere with what I wanted or what I needed or what I thought I had to have. I knew that those drives were so strong that they caused me to have a lot of fear associated with the future, worrying about, was I going to be able to get what I wanted? And was I going to be able to hold on to what I already had? And I knew that those drives were strong enough to cause me to do certain things that from time to time caused me to hurt people. And I know when I hurt those people, they in turn suffered pain and humiliation from that. And I know that they in turn would retaliate against me, and when they did, they created pain and suffering for me. And I knew that my life had become an absolute living hell, and I really didn't understand what the problem was. For a long time, I thought it was alcohol. But after I came in AA, I found out that alcohol really isn't the problem. The problem is that alcohol is simply an underlying symptom, or a symptom of many underlying problems that I have. And I begin to realize that my problem all my life has been in the way I think. And when I came to the big book Alcoholics Anonymous and I began to read and study this book, I began to find some startling information about myself. Now, rather than try to quote all these words and things from memory, I do want to go to the big book, and I want to use the big book this afternoon and do some actual reading out of the book to point out some of the points that we're going to try to be talking about. You know, if we had carefully read and studied our big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, if we had carefully read and studied the doctor's opinion and the first four chapters in the book, probably we would have realized three pertinent ideas. And those three pertinent ideas would have been that we were alcoholic and could not manage your own life. And they would have been that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And they would have been that God could and would if he were sought. And if we've carefully read and studied the doctor's opinion in the first four chapters, we know about our disease. We know about our hopeless condition of the mind and of the body. We've begun to see that it would take a power greater than human power to restore us to sanity. And my book says if we were convinced on these vital issues, we were now at step three, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to God as we understood him. Just what do we mean by that, and just what do we do? And it said the first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. On that basis, we are almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. And I think what our book is telling us, that a life run on self-will, which is what most of us have lived on most of our life, can hardly be a success, because running on self-will, we're always in collision with people, places, and things. And as we come in collision with people, places, and things, and they retaliate against us, then that creates anger and fear and frustrations and pain and humiliation for us. Now, I've got to remember that back in the beginning of the book, when I read the doctor's opinion, that it told me that whenever we're sober, we're restless, irritable, and discontented, until we can again experience the sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a few drinks. And the doctor is describing for me how I felt beforehand whenever I would get sober from time to time. And I would always be restless, and I would always be irritable, and I always discontented. And I was always filled with such things as shame, fear, guilt, and remorse based on the things I'd been doing as a practicing alcoholic. And I would be sober, and I wouldn't feel good, and I would want to feel better, and I really didn't know any way to feel better. And after a while, my mind would begin to fool with the idea of taking a drink. And it would start, maybe it would say, well, Charlie, you've been sober now about 90 days, and you've proven you're not an alcoholic. Or it would say, Charlie, surely you're not like the rest of those people. Surely you could have a couple of beers, and everything would be okay. And it would seem to me that all of a sudden my mind would just go zap and refuse to remember that I can't drink. And my mind would give me permission to drink. And then I would take the drink, and then I would trigger the allergy, and then I would end up drunk and sick and in all kinds of trouble. So I realized very early in the book that if I want to stay sober, I'm going to have to find a way to live. I can be sober and not be restless and not be irritable and not be discontented and not be filled with shame, fear, guilt, and remorse. Now, my book is telling me in step three that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success, because under those conditions, we're always in collision with people, places, and things. And because of those collisions with people, places, and things, then we're always restless, irritable, and discontented, and we're always filled with shame, fear, guilt, and remorse, living the kind of life that we, I think, then chances are the decisions that I make will be different. And if the decisions I make are different, then my actions will be different. And probably I'm going to have a better life. And I believe today, as I look at step three, where we made this decision to turn our will and our life, I love to look at those words. And today I believe that the word will pertains to my thinking apparatus, to my mind, the way I think. And my problem always before coming to AA has been that I've always had faulty thinking. And based upon my faulty thinking, I made bad decisions and took bad actions. I believe my life today is the sum total of everything that's happened to me throughout my lifetime, and it is the sum total of all the actions I've taken to get me where I am today. Now, always before, because of my bad decisions and bad actions, my life became an absolute living hell. And I think what I'm really going to do in step three is make a decision to turn my will, my thinking apparatus, and my life, which is my actions, over to the care of God as I understanding, hoping that my thinking and my actions will become better if God directs them for me. I've also got to look in step three at the word decision. You know, the word decision implies that we're going to take further action. And I hear people today who say, well, I've been sober 4 or 5 years. I don't understand what's wrong with me because I turned my will and my life over to the care of God when I took step three. And I don't really believe we turn it over in step three. I believe we make a decision to turn it over. And then we're going to have to take some action in order to carry that decision out. You know, my wife Barb and I, we've been going to California every fall for about 10 years. But we never did get to California because we would always decide to go in the fall of the year, but we never took the actions necessary to get us there. Year before last, we made a decision to go, and we took some action, and we got the car ready, and we packed the clothes, and we began driving down the road from my home to Tulsa, Oklahoma, to Oklahoma City, to Amarillo, to Albuquerque, to Flagstaff, and lo and behold, we ended up in California. And I had decided every year for years to go there, but I'd never been there before. So based upon my action that I took, I got the results that I wanted, I ended up in California. Now, I believe if we're going to decide to turn our will and our life, our thinking apparatus and our actions over to the care of God as we understand Him in step three, then we're going to have to take some action to carry that decision out. And none of us really wants to take that action because none of us wants to turn loose a self. And the book says, though, that any life run on that self-will can hardly be successful because we're always going to be in collision. And that in turn causes the restless, irritability, discontent, shame, fear, guilt, and remorse, which always leads me back to drinking. Today, I think, in order for me to get rid of self-will, I must understand what causes self-will in the first place. Well, to understand a problem, or to do anything about a problem if we don't understand what that problem is. And I've known all my life I've been angry. I've known all my life I've been fearful. I've known all my life that I've hurt other people, and I never did really want to do those things, and I would tell myself from time to time I'm not going to do them again, yet I would turn right around and do them all over again, and I find that my mind was as obsessed with those things as it ever was with drinking alcohol. And I always wanted not to do them, but I never could keep from not doing them because I never did really realize where they came from. And one day while reading the 12 and 12, in step four, I found on about 2 pages one of the greatest pieces of information I've ever found before about human nature. In the 12 and 12, where we're dealing with step four, Bill begins to talk to us about the three links of life. And he said that all human beings are born with these three basic instincts of life. And he said, they are placed in us by God, and they are God-given, and they are therefore good. And he said, without these three basic instincts of life, the human race would simply fail to survive. And he began to talk to us first about an instinct of life that he referred to as the social instinct. And he talks about the fact that the social instinct is the desire to be liked and accepted and respected by other people. Some people might want to refer to it as the herd instinct or whatever it is, but all human beings are born with a basic desire to be liked and accepted and respected by other people. And Bill tells us in the 12 and 12, the reason God put that in there or puts that in us is so that the human race will be able to survive. He said if we cared nothing for each other, nothing for the company of each other, we would go into a complete dog-eat-dog, anarchic situation, and sooner or later the human race would fail to survive, period. Now, there's certain words that we see under the social instinct from time to time. One we call self-esteem. And self-esteem, of course, is what we think of ourselves based primarily on what other people think of us or what we think other people think of us. We have words such as pride that goes under the social instinct. Pride is an unjustified view of oneself, either thinking too much of ourselves or thinking too little of ourselves, primarily, again, based upon what we think other people think of us. We have such things as personal relationships, words that we use quite often in our discussions with each other, and a personal relations, again, fall under this social instinct, our relationship with the world and the people in it. And he said, if we didn't have this, then the human race would fail to survive and we would die out completely. He then talked about a basic instinct that he referred to as the security instinct. Now, I know in AA we all live one day at a time. But I also know that the majority of us have insurance policies. And those insurance policies are made to protect ourselves in the future. God places within all human beings the desire to be secure in the future. If we did nothing about providing food, clothing, and shelter for the future, whenever the drought season came along, whenever the cold weather came along, we would starve to death, we would freeze to death, and etc., if we didn't have food, clothing, and shelter. All human beings are born with a desire to be secure in the future. Without that, the human race would simply fail to survive. Normally under this security instinct, you see one of two kinds. You see material and you see emotional. And of course, the material is our material things, such as our food, clothing, and shelter. Our emotional security usually is based, again, upon our relationship with other people. If we are overly people and they do not react to us right the way we think they should and give us the security we want, then we become very, very depressed, worried, and etc. Or if we're to dominate and control other people and they do not respond to us the way we think we should, again, we become angry, upset, and etc. And we become emotionally insecure. God also placed in all human beings the basic desire for sex. Now, it can be obscured by calamity. It can be turned off by bad happenings. It can be obscured by bad teachings. But in the beginning, God places in all human beings the basic desire for sex. Because if we didn't have sex, we wouldn't have any babies. And if we didn't have any babies, the human race, sooner or later, would simply fail to survive. And God has placed all three of these basic instincts in all human beings, and they're there at the moment of birth. Now, in order to fulfill these things, in order to respond to the basic instincts of life, it takes a lot of work. If I want to be socially secure, if I want people to like me and accept me and respect me, I've first got to find out, well, what is it that they want? And that may differ in different parts of the world. In one part of the world, it may be that what they demand and want of me is a high school education. In another part of the world, it may be a college education. In another part of the world, it may be just 6 years of education. Another part of the world, it may be a big home, a big house, a fine wife, a good job, being the boss, and so on and so forth. And I determine what it is that people want of me in order to be socially acceptable, And then I have to start working toward that. And I've got to work and work and work and work and work. And at the same time, I've probably got to quit doing some of the things that I love to do sometimes, or people aren't going to like me at all. Now, this work is so difficult that probably we would not do it if we didn't get a great reward for it. And Bill mentions in his story the fact that when he became successful on Wall Street, the words he used was, "I had arrived." And I think all of us have gone through that experience from time to time. We've set our goal, and we've worked, and we've strived, and we've done the best we can, and we get there, and my God, the feeling, because you have succeeded at what you set out to do. Now, the only thing wrong with that is it's just a temporary feeling. And it doesn't seem to last very long. And we're there, and we begin to get a little bored with where we are, and we begin to look around, and we begin to say, well, I need to do this then. And we set out, and again, we strive, and we strive, and we strive, and sometimes we can't do it fast enough. And sometimes people get in our way and prevent us from doing it the way we think we should. And sometimes we begin to do a little lying, conning, manipulating, cheating, and stealing. And when we do, we begin to hurt other people. And then they in turn react against us, and then that creates pain and suffering for us. All we're doing is responding to a God-given instinct. But the thing that we receive from it is so great that it seems to create an insatiable desire for more of the same, and we begin to do it in ways that God did not intend for it to be, and we start hurting other people. The same way with the security instinct. You know, if I want to be materially secure, I've got to determine, well, what is it that I need to be materially secure? In one part of the world, that might be $4. In another part of the world, it might be $400. Another might be $4,000. Another one might be $4 million. And in another part of the world, it might be 138 rocks, depending on what they measure material security by. And just as with the social instinct, if we want to be materially secure, we have to work for it. And we have to work and strive and save and invest. And the same as with the social instinct, we will probably have to quit doing some of the things we want to do. We can't always blow our money and throw it away if we want to be materially secure in the future. And it is such hard work, again, we probably would not do these things if we did not get the reward for it. And again, the reward comes from the great feeling we get whenever we've arrived. How many of us set our goal on a new automobile? How many of us set our goal on a new home? How many of us set our goal on a bank account an X number of dollars? And we strive and we strive and we strive and we finally get there, and my God, it's a feeling that is indescribably wonderful. We're there and it feels great. Now, the only thing wrong with it seems to be just a temporary feeling, and it doesn't last too long, and we become bored with where we are. We look around, and we set another goal, and we take off for that. I think they call that keeping up with the Joneses. And sometimes we can't get it fast enough, and sometimes people are standing in our way. And we begin again to con and lie and manipulate. We become very greedy people. We do not consider what other people want and need. And we begin to hurt people. And they in turn retaliate against us and create pain and suffering for us. Now the sex instinct is exactly like the other two. You know, sex is extremely hard work. It really is, you know. You can do more work in about 3 minutes of sex, if you can last that long, than you would do all day digging a damn ditch, you know? My Lord, you fall over sideways and the sweat's just pouring off of you and you can't hardly get your breath and you feel like you're going to die, and it is extremely hard work, and I doubt very seriously if we would do it if we didn't get a reward for it. And the reward that we get for sex successfully consummated is a great physical feeling and also a great feeling in our mind, a great emotional feeling. And it is a feeling which is absolutely indescribably wonderful. There's never been anything like it before. I doubt if there'll ever be anything like it again. But the same as with the other two basic instincts of life, that feeling is just a temporary feeling. You know, you no sooner get through with it than you begin to think a little bit about doing it again. And where you're going to do it and who you're going to do it with and what position you're going to do it in and so on and so forth. And it seems to create an insatiable desire of more for more of the same. And we're not getting what we want fast enough and we're not getting it the way we want. And we begin to demand more of other people and we begin to con and lie and manipulate and cheat and steal. And we begin to hurt people. And they in turn retaliate against us and that creates pain and suffering for us. And it becomes quite clear to me that if I want to stay sober, that something else is going to have to direct my thinking for me. Because based upon these three basic instincts of life, there's no way that I could keep from doing things that I shouldn't be doing. Now, since self-will is God-given, and that's what these three things create, is self. And if self-will is God-given, then only God can do anything about it. And I think one of the greatest mistakes that human beings are trying to make is they're trying to do something about self-will with self-will, and it simply doesn't work because we do not have the power to overcome these things that God placed in us in the beginning. So if I want to get my life to where I can live and be peaceful and happy and not be restless, not be irritable, not be discontented, then it's going to become necessary for me to try to let God take my self-will and let God direct my thinking. Now, God made a covenant with man many, many years ago. And that covenant was that He gave us self-will. And He will never take self-will back from us until we're ready to give it back to Him. Now, I used to think, well, God had just jerked His stuff out of me anytime He wanted to. But today I realize that God will not do that unless I am ready to have it done. So my book tells me that in step three, I must do something about self-will or I'm going to continue to be in trouble from now on. On page 62 in my book, it says selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of the problem. I'm so glad to know where it comes from. I never knew before where it came from. Today I do. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-pity, and self-seeking, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation. But we invariably find that at some time in the past we have made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. And as I go back and review my life and look at it, I realize that almost invariably the pain that I have suffered in my life, in my relationship with other people, was simply because I had made decisions based on self, which later placed me in a position for them to retaliate against me and create the pain and the suffering for me. And I didn't know that before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And the book says, so our troubles, we think, are basically out of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run right, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything, we may alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. We must or it kills us. God makes that possible. And there often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without His aid. Many of us had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them even though we would have liked to. Neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own power. We had to have God's help. This is the how and why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. You know, God's business is to run the world. And I've always tried to run the world. I've always tried to run me, and I've always tried to run everybody around me. My wife, my children, my boss, my co-worker, everybody around me to ensure that I'm going to get what I want. And this is really playing God because that's God's business. Next, we decided that hereafter in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. He is the principal, we are His agents. He is the father and we are His children. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we pass to freedom. So now I see why I need step three. Now I see why I need God to help me get rid of self-will. Now I see why I cannot stay sober operating on self-will. Bottom of page 63 in the big book. after we have used the prayer on 63, after we have asked God to take self-will away, at the bottom of the page it says, next we launched out on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us have never attempted. Though our decision referring to step three was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and to be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom, so we had to get down to causes and conditions. Now, I have never known all my life what blocked me off from God's will. I've simply known that I never did God's will, that I could never do His will, and that my self-will seemed to be so powerful that I couldn't keep from doing it. And my book is now saying, if I want God to direct my will for me, then I need to look within myself and find out what will block God off from directing my will. Therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. This was step four. A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. And here, Bill begins to use a little parable, and he's great at this. You know, we had another great teacher live some time ago, and we find it in another great book. And that teacher used parables also, and when he used parables, painting pictures with words, he always spoke in the words that the people he was talking to would understand. When he talked to the shepherd, he talked about sheep, and when he talked to the farmer, he talked about grain. When he talked to the fisherman, he talked about fish. Now, Bill has the same knack to do that and the ability to do that in the big book. He begins to talk to us about a commercial inventory, assuming that we know what a commercial inventory is. He says, a business which takes no inventory usually goes broke. And I think we all know that, and I think we all probably would agree with that. That if a business doesn't take an inventory once in a while, they don't know where they are. They don't know what they got on their shelves. They don't know how much has been sold. They don't know whether anybody's stealing from them or not. They don't know what has become a bad item. They don't know what they need to replace, and sooner or later they're going to go broke. And he says, taking a commercial inventory is a fact finding and a fact facing effort to discover the truth about the stock in trade. Now, Bill never in the big book used these words and things unless he was going to tie it in with what he wanted us to do. And I find the commercial inventory is a fact-finding and a fact-facing effort to discover the truth about the stock in trade, and the stock in trade being what's in the store or what's on the shelf. Now, he turned right around and wrote for you and I step four. And our step four says we made a searching, and if you'll notice, searching is the same thing as fact-finding. And he said we made a fearless, and if you'll notice, that's the same as fact-facing. He said we made a searching and fearless moral inventory. Now, I think the greatest disservice that's ever been paid to you and I or anybody else in AA is somewhere we picked up on the word moral and we decided that meant a list of dirty, filthy, nasty things. And I really don't believe that's what was intended. I think if he had wanted us to inventory only our dirty, filthy, nasty things, he would have said, made a searching and fearless immoral inventory or amoral inventory. And he didn't say that. He said the word moral. And one day I got so concerned about this, I went to the dictionary and I looked up the word moral and I found a definition that I believe fits what we're talking about. One definition of the word moral is truth. We are making a searching and fearless, truthful inventory is what we're going to do. Now, what are we going to inventory as we sell? We're going to inventory also our stock in trade, just like a commercial inventory does. You know, you and I have a business. And you and I have one of the most important businesses in the world. And our business is this business of sobriety. Now, whether we're going to stay sober or not is going to depend upon our stock in trade also. And our stock in trade, we all know, is how we think. And whether we're going to stay sober or not depends on how we think. That we did with the commercial inventory, we're going to make a searching, fearless, truthful inventory about our stock in trade also. Now, in this commercial inventory, whether he goes broke tomorrow or not is not going to depend on what he had on his shelves 20 years ago. Nor is it going to depend what he's going to have on his shelf 20 years from now. Whether he goes broke tomorrow or not is going to depend upon what's on his shelf today. Now, in my business of staying sober, whether I go broke tomorrow or not is not going to depend upon how I thought 20 years ago. And it's not going to depend on how I think 20 years from now. It's going to depend upon how I think today. And my book is getting ready to tell me I need to inventory the thoughts in my mind that are the outgrowth of self-will, which comes from the three basic instincts of life in the beginning. It says, we did exactly the same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly. That's the moral inventory. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure. Being convinced that self manifested in various ways is what had defeated us, we considered its common manifestations. Now remember, we're talking about how we think. We're not dealing with the physical thing. We're talking about how we think. We're going to consider manifestations of self-will, which stems from those three basic instincts of life that we put on the board a while ago. You show us a selfish, self-centered person, and we'll show you one that's always madder than hell. The world isn't treating him right. People aren't doing what he wants them to do. And so on and so on and so forth, and he's always mad and upset and angry at people, at the federal government, at the police, at God, everything that comes down the turnpike. We see him every day. Show me a selfish, self-centered person, and we'll show you one that is always filled with fear. Always filled with fear. Operating on self, you have nobody else to depend upon but yourself. And we're always scared to death that we're not going to get the things that we need, or we're scared to death that we're going to lose some of those things we've already got, and we're always operating on fear. You know, we're kind of like the guy in Little Abner. Y'all remember him. He used to run around, and he had a rain cloud hanging over his head, and he had raindrops falling out of it. And everywhere he went, he created absolute catastrophe. You know, I think his name was Joe Blitzfig or something like that. And I'm just like him. I never knew what was going to happen tomorrow, but I knew, by God, when it got here, it wasn't going to be worth a damn. You know? Always running on fear. Show me a selfish, self-centered person, and we'll show you one who's always harming other people. He doesn't care what other people want. He doesn't care what other people needs. And if he does, he's unable to keep from doing it. And he's always doing the wrong thing at the wrong time and the wrong place with the wrong people. And he's always hurting and harming other people. And we see them every day. My book says what I need to do is consider these common manifestations of self, with resentment being number one. It said resentment is the number one offender. This anger that we have, this pains that we have, this refeeling of these old hurts that have gone in our life. My book says resentment is the number one offender. Said it killed more alcoholics than anything else. And it said in dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. Now this should lay to rest forever the question of whether we take a written inventory or whether we take a mental inventory. If you're going to set these resentments on paper, as the big book says to do it, then you've almost got to have first a piece of paper. You've got to have a pen, a pencil, a paintbrush, a typewriter, or something to write it down with. You know, if you go to the dictionary and look up the word inventory, you will even find it described as a written list of items. And if we're going to inventory as our book says to, it will be a written list. Now, I think one of the greatest failings we've had with our fourth step is that in the instructions on how to take step four, they are so short, so small, so tiny, that most of us have overlooked them in the past and we've never been able to see them. I think also one reason we've had such great difficulty with is the example on page 65, where Bill has filled out that sheet. The problem is he already filled it out, and we don't know how he filled it out. So when it came to our inventory, we had mass confusion. Somewhere in there it said all of our life story, and somebody said, well, you ought to write down everything you can remember from the day you were born. Somebody else said, why don't you write that place up there in Minnesota and get their inventory guide and use it? And somebody said, there's one coming out of Texas, get it. So you write your life story, you get both inventory guides, you get the big book, and you try to mix it all together, and God, no wonder we're confused on how to take our inventory. The big book gives us exact, explicit instructions on how to take an inventory. I'm going to tell you, I'm going to run you over a little bit. We're not going to quit at 5. If you have to leave, go ahead and leave. That'd be great. But we'll try not to run too far, okay? The big book says this. The first instruction is that we listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we were angry. We listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we were angry. On the example on page 65, he has it divided up into three columns, with the left-hand column being, I'm resentful at. And underneath that, he listed the people he's resentful at. And he listed Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, my employer, and my wife. Now, probably Bill had more resentments than that. He just didn't want to take up any more time here on this sheet, I'm sure. And he showed us those four as examples. Now, the important thing about this is the first thing we do is list the people, institutions, and principles to whom we were angry. We do all of column one at one time. We don't try to do columns two and three, because if you do, your mind's got to change. And while we've got our mind on those people, those institutions such as the police, those principles such as the Ten Commandments that we resent, we fill out the left-hand column in its entirety. And anybody can do this. Everybody knows who they're mad at. You don't even have to be sober a long time to know who you're mad at. Hell, I've always known who I'm mad at. And it wasn't hard for me to make this list. After I completed that list, the second instruction was, we ask ourselves why we were angry. And he headed up column two as the cause of the anger. We now go back to each name individually. And by the side of each name that we've written down in column one, we also the anger. In his particular case, he's mad at Mr. Brown because of his attention to my wife. He told my wife about my mistress, and Brown might get my job at the office. I don't blame him. I'd be madder than hell at Brown, too. I think anybody would. Yeah. He was mad at his wife because she missed some eggs. And she likes old Brown. And she wants the house put in her name. My God, you tie together liking Brown and wanting the house put in her name. It's time to get upset about something. And very carefully we make a list of the causes of the... We found that our self-esteem, our pocketbooks, our ambitions, our personal relationships, including sex, were hurt or threatened, so we were sore, we were burned up. On our grudge list, we set opposite each name our injuries. Was it our self-esteem, our security, our ambitions, our personal or sex relations would have been interfered with? That's why we must look at the three basic instincts of life when we're dealing with step three. It's impossible for me to be mad at you unless you have threatened one of my three basic instincts of life, or unless you are interfering with what I want, trying to fulfill my three basic instincts of life. You threaten my social standing, and by golly, I'm mad.
You threaten my security, I'm mad. You threaten my sex life, and I'm mad. And we write down very carefully by the side of each name which of these things had been interfered with. And as an example, again, for Mr. Brown, his attention to my wife, and what's been interfered with there, it is my sex relations and my self-esteem. You know, Brown gets to fooling around my wife, and she finds out he's better than I am, then by golly, she's going to cut me off at home probably. And then what are other people going to think of me if that happens? He's also mad at Brown because Brown told his wife about his mistress. Now, boy, you talk about a threat to sex relations. The wife cut him off immediately at home, and she didn't stop there. She went over to the mistress and raised enough hell with the mistress that now the mistress has got him cut off, and he ain't got no sex relations at all. And again, it's a threat to his self-esteem. Now, if we do this sheet, as the big book says to do it, we're going to learn two or three things almost immediately. Number one is we're going to learn how angry we really are. I didn't know I was that angry. Oh, I had three or four names I could see in my head. But when I started putting them down on paper, I found that I was angry with damn near everything that came along. And I began to realize how much anger. The second thing I realized is this, that it's not the people I'm so mad at as what they did that I'm mad at. You know, I could take Mr. Brown off of here, put Mr. Green in, and I'd be just as mad at Mr. Green. I could take Mrs. Jones off of here and put Miss Pumpernickel, and I'd be just as mad at Miss Pumper. I'm not so mad at people as I am what they did. The third thing I realize is that it's not so much what they did, but my reaction to it based on self, on the basic instincts of life. And for the first time, I could see where my anger came from. You know, I know it's my reaction to it. One day you can do it to me, and if I'm right, you can't hurt me, and it'll just go right off my back like water off a duck's back. Do it to me again a week from now, I'm not right, and man, I blow my stack and go right through the ceiling. For the first time in my life, I recognized where anger came from. I learned three things immediately, but that isn't all I learned. On the next page, it told me that any life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. Leads only to futility and unhappiness. And it says, to the precise extent that we permit these, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile? Now, I don't know about you, but I used to get up in the morning when I was drinking, I'd have a cup of coffee, drink a whiskey, turn on my resentment machine, and replay what all them dudes did to me last week, last month, last year, 20 years ago, and I could spend an hour doing it. And as soon as I got through with that, I would turn on my get-even machine and figure out what I'm going to do to them dudes the next time I see them. They're going to say this, I'm going to say that, they're going to do this, and socko, I'm going to lay it in them, and by golly, I'm going to show them. Now, I look back in my life today, and to the best of my knowledge, I've never made a nickel doing that. I never got even with one of them. I never succeeded at what I was going to do with them. And those hours were absolutely, completely wasted. Now, that's bad. Because we only got so many hours to live anyhow. And as we get older and older, and we squander more and more of these hours, we're simply taking away the time that we could be happy. But that isn't the real problem. My book said, but with the alcoholic whose hope is the maintenance and growth of the spiritual experience, this business of resentment is infinitely grave. We found that it is fatal. For when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the Spirit. We shut ourselves off from God's will. Then it says, the insanity of alcohol returns. And insanity for we alcoholics is to believe we can drink. And we begin to believe we can drink, and it says, we drink again, and with us to drink is to die. It said if we were to live, we had to be free of anger. The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us, and they may be the dubious luxury of normal men, but for alcoholics, these things are poison. So no longer is it a question in my mind as to whether a resentment is justified or unjustified. No longer is it a question of who's right and who's wrong. The only question in my mind today is, what does a resentment do to me? And it cuts me off from the sunlight of the Spirit, from God's will. And cut off from God's will, I remain restless and irritable and discontent. I remain full of shame, fear, guilt, and remorse, and sooner or later my mind seeks relief and it turns back to drinking, and my mind says it's okay to drink, and then I take the drink and I trigger the allergy and I'm down the tubes again. And it says if we were to live, we had to be free of that. It said these things must be mastered, but how? The book then tells me how to get rid of them. This book is so great that it never leaves me hanging out anywhere. It's told me what they do to me, how to get rid of them. And it tells me that in order to get rid of those things, I'm going to need to pray for that individual. It said, this was our course. We realized that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Though we did not like their symptoms and the way these disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too. We asked God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. When a person offended, we said to ourselves, this is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? God, save me from being angry. Thy will be done. And I find that if I want to get rid of resentments, and I pray for those that I resent, that those resentments will disappear. And for the first time in my life, I can find myself free from anger. And then my book said, referring to the list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, we resolutely look for our own mistakes. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? And it lists here four basic character defects, four basic parts of my personality, which are the outgrowth of self. Because of my selfishness, because of my dishonesty, because of my self-seeking, because of my being frightened, because of my inconsideration of other people, I'm always doing things that place me in a position to be hurt, and they retaliate, and that creates pain, and I get madder in hell at them for doing it. Rationalize away what I did, get mad at them. And I begin to see the exact nature of the wrongs, the character defects, the shortcomings that I'm going to have to do something about. Because if I stay selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, inconsiderate, then sooner or later, I'm going to get resentments back. And sooner or later, as they come back, I'm blocked off from God's will again. I drink, down the tubes I go. I've looked at the first common manifestation very shortly, very, very shortly. On the bottom of page 67, it says, notice that the word fear is bracketed along the difficulties of Mr. Brown. And it begins to talk to me about looking at fear. And I do the same thing with fear. Fear is an outgrowth of self. I can't be fearful unless there's some threat to one of my three basic instincts of life. I make a list of fears. I list why do I have that fear. And in most cases, I can determine why I have it. One of my great fears was the Internal Revenue Service. And the reason I feared the Internal Revenue Service is because I cheated on my income tax. Another one of my great fears was my wife, Barbara. And why did I have the fear? Because she filed three times for divorce the last year I drank, and I'm not so damn sure she still won't do it today. And we got thousands of fears within us. We men like to say, oh, we're not afraid. We're not afraid. We're tough, you know. But we're not talking about physical fear. We're talking about fears of the mind. And we got 1,000 of them up here that run around in our head all day long. And those fears cause us to make certain decisions. And those decisions cause us to take action. And then those actions create problems with other people. And if I want to live, I've got to be free of fear the same as I've got to be free of anger. And my book tells me exactly how to look at it. We do it the same way we did resentments. Then it tells me how to get rid of fear. It never leaves me hanging out. At the bottom of the third paragraph on page 68, it says, we never apologize for God. Instead, we let Him demonstrate to us what He can do. We ask Him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what He would have us be. At once, we commence to outgrow fear. And we treat fears as we did resentments, and slowly, 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 the fears begin to disappear. Now, just think. Here's a mind that's operated on resentment and fear all of its life. And slowly those things are disappearing. Nature will not allow a vacuum or a void anywhere in the universe. Everything is always rushing into vacuums and voids to fill it up. And nature's not going to allow a vacuum in a personality. My mind will always be filled with something. And if resentments and fears are disappearing, then something else must come in to take their place. And it's going to be the opposite of what they are. With resentment gone, I'm going to be more understanding and more tolerant of other people. With fears disappearing, I'm going to be able to use courage and do the things that I never thought I could do before because I was always afraid to do them. Now, one final item it wants me to look at, and that's the area where I harm people. And it said, now about sex. And finally, we're getting down to sex. It won't take but a minute. Now, it says, many of us needed an overhauling there. Never did take me but about a minute. I don't know why it'd take any longer. It says, many of us needed an overhauling there. Now, you older fellas, don't get your hopes up. We're not dealing with physical sex. We're dealing with the way we think about sex. There's a difference in human beings and the rest of the race, rest of the animals on the face of the earth when it comes to sex. All animals on the face of the earth have three basic instincts of life. All of them have the herd instinct to a certain extent. All of them have security instincts. You see squirrels storing nuts in a tree. All of them have sex instincts so they can procreate their race, whatever it might be, whether it's cows, squirrels, birds, or whatever. They have the same three basic instincts, but they do not have self-will, which we have. Now, sometimes I wonder if self-will that God gave to us is a blessing or if it's a curse. We're the only animals on the face of the earth that He allows to think. We're the only animals on the face of the earth that He allows to reason. We're the only animals on the face of the earth that He allows to make decisions about what they want to do. All other animals are God-directed. Therefore, their life is usually good. You very seldom see one of them in a divorce court, hardly ever in a doctor's office with ulcers, because they're responding to what God wants them to be and are doing it at the exact level God wants it, and therefore they are happy, peaceful, and serene. Nothing's prettier or more happy than a bird or a squirrel, and etc. But we humans are allowed to think about these things. And I think here's the basic trouble with sex. It's not how we do sex, but it's how we think about sex. And God wanted us to be able to become emotionally involved with sex because sex is at the core of the family unit. Without emotional involvement, men and women would not remain together. And if they did not remain together, they would not have the combined strength of both in order to raise the offspring to create the family. And without the family units, we would not have the city units, the country units, etc. And man, let's see very briefly what the book says about sex. It said, but above all, we tried to be sensible on this question. It's so easy to get way off the track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes, absurd extremes perhaps. One set of voices cry that sex is a lust of our lower nature, a base necessity of procreation, and we've got that set of voices. You know, they're the ones that say that sex is bad, that it's bad to enjoy sex, that you ought to have sex one time, one place, one position, one person, for one purpose, and that's to have babies, and anything else is bad. And we've always had that set of voices on one side. Then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think we do not have enough of it or that it isn't the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. One school would allow a man no flavor for his fare, and the other would have us all on a straight pepper diet. You know, I think that last school of thought, probably today, they would call that the sexual revolution. And I really don't have anything wrong with the sexual revolution, except that it happened 20 years too late for me to do anything about it. Now then, my book says to me one of the most pleasing statements I've ever read in it. It said, we want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be one's sex conduct. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. What can we do about them? We reviewed our own conduct over the years past. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Whom had we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? We got this all down on paper and looked at it. And again, I don't think we can see in our mind what sex does to us and how sex controls us and dominates us until we get this information down on a piece of paper. You know, the mind's only capable of looking at one thing at a time. And there's no way I can see what sex does to me until I get it all down on a piece of paper. So I made another sheet, and I made it just exactly like the resentment sheet. On the left-hand column, I said, who did I hurt? And everybody knows who they hurt, and we listed their names. In the middle column, I put down, what did I do? And everybody knows what they've done to hurt other people sexually. And in the third column, I put down which part of self caused it. And I found one of the most interesting pieces of information I've ever found in my life. And that's this. I thought until I did this inventory on sex that anything that I had ever done wrong sexually that hurt other people was causing it. And as soon as I filled this sheet out, I began to realize that that's not necessarily true. I found that once in a great while, in order to get the sexual, physical release and gratification, which comes that I had responded to the basic sex instinct in order to do it. But the next thing I realized was this, that most of my sexual wrongs were caused by either the social instinct or by the security instinct, one of the two. You know, as boys growing up, we fellas found out a long time ago that you could use sex to build your own ego, to build your self-esteem. After all, the more members of the opposite sex you're attractive to, and the more you can get, then the greater stud you really are. Now, we boys call it John Wayneism. I don't know what you girls call it, but we boys called it John Wayneism. We found out a long time ago that you can use sex to get affection from another human being. We found that you can use sex to buy affection from another human being. That maybe we didn't want to do sex, but if we did it, then that other person would like us, and that other person would be kind to us. And we begin to use sex for purposes other than what God intended for it to be. You know, we can use sex to buy material security. Sometimes we find ourselves in sexual situations where we're overly dependent upon another human being, and that person's wanting to do things sexually we don't want to do, but we can't afford to tell them no because we are dependent upon them to take care of us materially. Sometimes we use sex to get even. You know, we find that we're in a relationship with another human being, and that human being goes out and does something they shouldn't do and hurts us, and then we in turn retaliate, and we say, by God, we'll show them. And then we go do the same damn thing, and we used it. That's not God's purposes. We use sex to get even with people. Sometimes we can use sex to force our will on other people. They're not doing what we want them to do, and we say, by golly, we'll show them. We'll just cut them off at the pass, and we ain't going to have no sex with them until they do what we want them to do. Now, we boys can only hold out at about 2 or 3 days at that. But now I guarantee you, you girls have got her down to perfection. You know, you can... Hell, you can go months at that, you know, and it works, too. It really does work. The only thing I'm trying to do as I take my sexual inventory is to try to see how sex has controlled my life, to try to see what sex has caused me to do, to try to see that I've hurt people through sex for purposes other than what God intended for it to be. My book said, in this way, we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. We subjected each relation to this test. Was it selfish or not? You know, the big book doesn't care how you do sex. Lord, if you want to do sex hanging upside down from a tree by your toenails, that's perfectly all right with the big book. But if you're forcing another human being to have sex from the same tree limb by their toenails when... We remembered always that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised and loathed. Whatever our ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to make amends where we've done harm, provided that we do not bring about still more harm in so doing. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answers will come if we want it. God alone can judge our sex situation. Counsel with persons is often desirable, but we let God be the final judge. We realize that some people are as fanatical about sex as others are loose. We avoid hysterical thinking or advice. You know, we could throw a sexual problem out here today in this room. and we'd get 50 different answers for it. Now he says God alone can judge our sex situation. We turn to Him and seek advice. Now suppose we fall short of the chosen ideal and stumble. Does this mean we're going to get drunk? Some people tell us so, but this is only a half-truth. It depends on us and our motives. Now the book didn't say this on resentments and fears, but it does on sex. And it realizes that sex is such a powerful drive that irregardless of how hard we try to control this thing, that from time to time we might screw up. You know, thank God I'm getting older where it's not that bad anymore. If we are sorry for what we have done and have the honest desire to let God take us to better things, we believe we will be forgiven and will have learned our lesson. Sorry. And our conduct continues to harm others, we're quite sure to get drunk. We are not theorizing. These are facts out of our experience. And again, it's not a question of right and wrong. It's not a question of morality. It's not a question of whether I want to or don't want to stop these things. The only question in my mind is, if I continue to do those things and I continue to harm people, am I going to be able to stay sober? Very doubtful. Because it creates within my mind the fear, the guilt, the remorse, those things. And that blocks me off from the sunlight of the Spirit, and I'm probably going to drink. To sum up about sex, we earnestly pray for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity, and for the strength to do the right thing. If sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. We think of their needs and work for them, and this takes us out of ourselves. It quiets the imperious urge when to yield would mean heartache. If you've got a real problem with sex, know what to do about it. And if it's giving you trouble all the time, my book gives me a sure thing that'll work. It says, start helping other people. Throw ourselves the harder into helping other people. And it seems as though that's about the only time when we get our mind off ourselves. It's when we've got it concentrated on helping another person. And maybe while we're out to lunch helping another person, there's a possibility God can come in and straighten that mess up, whatever it can be. But He can't come in there as long as my mind is churning, 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 and churning. Now this is what Bill did when he called on Dr. Bob, not because of sex, but because he was about to get drunk. And he realized that even though he had never helped anybody in New York City, that every time he did, he had felt better. And he called on Dr. Bob to keep Bill from getting drunk. And that got Bill out of his own troubles. And he got to working with Bob, and lo and behold, Bill didn't have to drink. And the book says the same thing will work for me in the area of sex. If we've been thorough about our personal inventory, we've written down a lot. We have listed and analyzed our resentments. We've begun to comprehend their futility and their fatality. We've commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. We've begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward all men, even our enemies, for we look on them as sick people. We have listed the people we've hurt by our conduct and are willing to straighten out the past if we can. In this book, you read again and again that faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. We hope you are now convinced that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from Him. If you've already made a decision, step 3, and an inventory of your grosser handicaps, you've made a good beginning. That being so, you've swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. Grosser handicaps. Another great mistake going on in AA today is we want to wait to do step 4 until we're absolutely sure we can do it perfect. You know, you don't get well and then work the steps. You work the steps in order to get well. And the book realizes that the best we can possibly do on step 4 in the beginning here is to look at the grosser handicaps. And they are resentments, fears, harms we've done to other people, primarily in the sexual area. I love the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. It always tells me what I need to know. It tells me what I need to look at. It tells me how to handle what it is that I found. It never leaves me out in the cold. Just think, if you completed step 4 and you got rid of resentments and fears, and you're getting rid of the fear and the remorse and the guilt associated with the things you've done in the past, for the first time in our life, for most of us, we begin to be sober and experience peace of mind, serenity, and happiness at the same time. And if we already feel good, then we don't need to drink in order to feel better. Thank you all for being here this afternoon.
Thank you very much, Charlie. What a presentation, I swear. Well, if there's not any more, let's close by joining hand and pray together the Lord's Prayer.
I need to say one more thing to you I forgot to say. There are no experts or gurus in Alcoholics Anonymous. The opinions you heard me express are my own opinions as of today. Nobody speaks for AA as a whole. Thank you.